Previously on Beta.
Snoop me a clipper. I'll be back for Christmas.
That goes for every last one of you, regardless of your race, color, or your creed. Let's get this thing on the hump. We got some flying to do.
It's the end of the world.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up in the next hour, comedian Eric Andre joins us to talk about his debut Netflix special, Legalize Everything.
You can't go too harsh with the moms or the audience kind of turns on you. You don't want to be mean to the moms. But everybody can relate to mom confusion, and it's totally G-rated after all this like hard R material.
Also, Otessa Moshfegh on her latest novel, Death in Her Hands, in which an elderly woman becomes obsessed with a local murder mystery.
I think there are always multiple ways to interpret anything, because that's the whole thing about language. It's just words, and words require interpretation.
And we pick the brain of Milwaukee's own Patrick McGilligan to dissect Mel Brooks' 1974 comedy horror movie, Young Frankenstein.
You might miss Mel because Mel could be very funny on the screen in his parts. But nonetheless, it makes it his strongest film as a director.
But first, we here at Beta hope that you're well and staying safe during this unprecedented time. I've been seeing lists of pandemic novels to read during this coronavirus pandemic. One novel that keeps popping up is Chuck Wendig's Wanderers. That's because the dystopian tale about a plague of sleepwalkers bears some strange synchronicities with our current situation, as you'll soon discover in our conversation. But first, here's Chuck reading an excerpt from Wanderers.
It was then she saw the girl's eyes. They were open. Her sister's gaze stood fixed at nothing, like she was looking through Shayna or staring around her. Dead eyes, dead like the flat tops of fat nails. Gone was the luster of wonder, that spark. Barefoot, Nessie continued on. Shayna didn't know what to do. Move out of her way, stand planted like a telephone pole. Her indecision forced her to do a little of both. She shifted left just a little, but still in her sister's inevitable path. The girl's shoulder clipped her hard. Shayna staggered left, taking the hit. The laugh that came up out of her was one of surprise, was a pissed-off laugh, a bark of incredulity. "That hurt, dummy," she said, and then grabbed through the girl's shoulder and shook her. Nothing. Nessie just pulled away and kept going. Nessie. Nessie.
Can you give us a brief outline of what happens in Wanderers without revealing any spoilers?
Without revealing, that's tricky. It starts off with a Nessie sleepwalking down the road, and one by one, other sleepwalkers come out of their house and join her. And they begin to form a flock of people, and the story is ultimately about who these people are who protect the flock, the quote-unquote shepherds, about what the sleepwalker's purpose is. It itself is sort of viewed as a kind of pandemic, but then a different pandemic rises in the book, a pandemic called White Mask. And it's all about how the sleepwalker flock entangles with that and how they affect it and what it means. It's about America and how, it's sort of a pre or peri-apocalyptic story.
It sounds somewhat like the coronavirus pandemic, but the hardcover version of your book actually came out last summer, last July. Did you ever think that this story, while you were writing it, did you ever think it could possibly predict this kind of pandemic?
Not maybe to the exact beats we're experiencing right now, but I mean, you know, a pandemic is not, we act like it's an unusual thing. A pandemic level disease, or at least a capable pandemic disease, usually pops up once a decade or so. Usually they're just something we either get ahead of or that turn out to be not quite as bad as we worried they could be. But, you know, between the flu of 1918 or SARS and MERS and swine flu, and I mean, you know, we see this a lot. This one just happens to have gotten its teeth in for a variety of perfect storm type reasons.
Mm-hmm. When did you first realize that your sprawling story, the story that came out of your brain, was kind of a real thing that is now actually happening?
There were a few moments, like with the obviously the origin point in bats, which is a thing in the book. And, we have things like rise of white supremacy and militias who are sort of seizing on opportunities. So that's been a troubling bookmark. But there were a few pieces that were definitely more concerning in how they mirrored book to reality. The first was that in the book, there's an artificial intelligence called Black Swan that predicts the coming of the pandemic before humans see it. And in our reality, I read an article that was about how there was an algorithm called Blue Dot that had predicted it, which seemed a little on the nose for, you know, between Black Swan and Blue Dot. And then there was the book also opens with a comet, a sort of fortuitous, theoretically prophetic comet. And in the reality now, there's a comet called Comet Swan, which is appearing. And so I was just like, oh, with Black Swan and Blue Dot and Comet Swan, it's all a little much.
In Wanderers, you explore the spread of this epidemic and the frightening ways in which America's social fabric unravels under that strain, as you mentioned just a moment ago. Which do you think is scarier?
The social unraveling is scary because a pandemic is neutral. You know what I mean? A disease mm-hmm. is not something that doesn't hate us. It just does what it does. But, you know, other people, when things like the norms and the sort of social contract begins to break down, that's a scarier point. And I will note that I don't think that's really happened in reality. It does certainly kind of happen in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You also look at the similarities between how information and disinformation go viral and the way that the disease in your book goes viral. How do you think those similarities influenced the way you wrote the book?
The book really tries to handle, or at least portray, social media, for one thing, and how information goes, as you say, viral. I think both of those things are real, both real in the book and real in reality in terms of that breaking of the social contract we were just talking about. That's a thing that happens often because of mis- and disinformation that spread easily, almost in the same kind of vector in the way that disease does, a certain level of proximity. Social media puts it in front of us more easily, just as the coronavirus will seize on our opportunities or seize on the opportunity if we're all together in a closed space. And the internet effectively makes us all in a closed space. And so, especially with certain kinds of echo chambers, and if you join a certain Facebook group and it's geared toward a certain way, it gets easier if bad or mis- or disinformation gets in that, it can go around much quicker and root itself more easily.
Your novel's been compared to Stephen King's The Stand, which was originally published in 1978, and you even admit that The Stand is an influence in your book. Why, yes. Why did you want to be so upfront about King's influence on your book?
First of all, to not acknowledge that would be a huge lie. I mean, I read The Stand very early, and it's one of those things that dug its heels in, and so I have it with me. It's hard not, I mean, I would have to willfully write in opposition to it. And that doesn't feel true to what I was trying to do. So I figured it's better to acknowledge it. And also in terms of the book's world, I didn't want it to be like, you know, The Walking Dead, where they pretend like zombies are a new thing they've never heard of before. Like it's the Stand exists in the world of the Wanderers. And it's a book that the characters are aware of. So in fact, Stephen King, there's a lot of little homages to King that are peppered throughout. And I don't feel any need to hide that, even though while there are some similarities, obviously this is a very different book in that it's more science fiction and not really supernatural in any way. I definitely wanted to wear those comparisons on my sleeve. I think it's a thing I'm happy about.
Stephen King says he's still apologizing all these years later when people wearing masks come up to him and say they feel like they're living in a Stephen King story. So I'm curious, do people ever come up to you and tell you they feel like they're living in a Chuck Wendig novel?
I get emails and tweets and comments every day about how this is some Wanderers level business. A new piece of news will drop and people will quote tweet me or tweet at me about it. Like, this is, hey, look at this. This is from a book we all know. It's like, oh, whoops.
Yeah. Yeah. At one point in your book, one of your main characters, Dr. Benjamin Ray, has this epiphany. He realizes that humankind is a disease. The earth is the body and climate change is the fever. And then he thinks that the solution is to kill the parasite and save the host. Do you think that these thoughts have any implications for what the world is going through with the coronavirus epidemic right now?
Well, in terms of whether or not that's really what the coronavirus's function is, no. I mean, I don't imagine that there's any particular intelligence at work, whether it's divine or some sort of massive science intelligence, the Gaia effect or something. But it's certainly an ethos that he considers from a sort of an abstract standpoint. And I think it's at least worth thinking about how what's going on right now is impacting our environment and in some cases making it healthier, but while also maybe setting some of the climate change fight back because of various resource deferments. And if we have economic downturn, then that'll make it harder to maybe prep for coming climate change. So it's definitely one of those things where they're entangled together. And, you know, if they're talking about a supercharged hurricane season, what that will mean for the people who are, you know, sheltering in place or coronavirus, quarantine and lockdown.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier one of the differences between your book, Wanderers, and Stephen King's The Stand is that yours has a lot more science in it. And I was really impressed the way you grounded it in science. You must have had to do a lot of research.
I am a really lazy writer. So part of it is that I did obviously do research for this, but a lot of it is research that I was doing before I ever wrote or even had the idea for the book. I'm lazy in the sense that the books I write tend to make use of the stuff that I'm interested in, the stuff that I've read about or that has triggered a response inside me. It's not necessarily, it's all chicken and egg stuff, right? But the book kind of comes out of all of these anxieties I have and all of these things I've read about and all of these books that I've already investigated and people I'm friends with who I've talked to. So the research was mostly building on a foundation of what I had already been looking at in terms of epidemiology and climate change and artificial intelligence. You know, these are sort of interests of mine that dovetail together into this big crazy Voltron of a book.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about that. I have a follow-up question about that. So you were researching this stuff anyway, epidemiology and all these other topics you were interested in, before you had the idea for Wanderers. Was there sort of a tipping point? Can you point to an aha moment kind of thing where you came up with the idea for Wanderers based on all this research you'd been doing?
Yeah, the core idea of Wanderers, which is to say the sleepwalkers walking, was something that was with me for years. You know, I kind of devote my ideas to what I call my idea thunderdome inside my brain. Like, I just let them fight it out. I don't write them down anymore. I don't assume that any idea is particularly of value. But if an idea stays with me and it's persistent and wants to bug me and demand to be written, then usually I'll come back to it. So this is one that stayed with me, but I had no story. I had no characters for it. I had no real narrative for it. And that's the meat of why we come to books. It's not for the hook maybe gets us on page one and that's what gets us reading, but we stay for the characters and for the themes and for everything that's sort of tangled in there. And so for me, it was really the buildup to 2016 that coalesced into what I wanted to do with this book. It was all of the political stuff, all of the climate change, the sort of this host of coming trouble coalesced and contextualized. Again, I guess you could say forming that Voltron inside my brain. And then I had a book. Just it made sense to me all of a sudden.
You have this quote from a fictional science writer named Afzad Kerman in your book, and I'd like you to read the first sentence from it. The idea is that this is a quote from a TED Talk he gave, and the first sentence really resonated with me, if you wouldn't mind reading it.
Sure. So science writer Afzad Kerman, in his TED Talk, Chaos and Crisis, The Accidental Ingenuity of the Almost Apocalypse, says, "Here's how we do things in America. We identify a problem, then we promptly ignore it, until it's not just biting our ass, but it's already eaten the right cheek and has started on the left."
Yeah, that really resonates with what we've been going through. A lot of people right now seem to be reading novels about pandemics during this pandemic. Why do you think that's the case?
I don't know. Honestly, I assume that there is some level of contextualization that they're seeking. You know, when I was in the 90s and we were, you know, still kind of in the midst of 80s and 90s, I should say, we're still in the midst of a nuclear panic. I read Robert McCammon's Swan Song, which is a horror epic horror novel about, you know, a nuclear winter. And I read it almost because I was scared of it. And then I don't know exactly what that does for you, except that it gives you a level of control over it and context. And also, obviously, the book is portraying the worst possible version. So there's that. But also with a book like Wanderers, as much as what's happening in the book is horrific and definitely worse than what we're enduring now, at the same time, I also think it's full of, I try to make it full of hope and humor and heart and give it a sense of it's not just a nihilistic march to the end. There's a story in there. And so it gives us almost like a vacation from the current reality into something adjacent but different.
Chuck Wendig, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chuck Wendig is a novelist, comic book writer, and screenwriter. His latest book is called Wanderers. Find out more about Chuck at wpr.org/beta.
They're just blindsided by everything. And we purposely try not to book guests that would watch Adult Swim or watch the show. We try to book guests out of the world of that kind of comedy. We don't book comedians.
Comedian Eric Andre talks about his surreal talk show parody and his debut Netflix stand-up special, Legalize Everything. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Comedian Eric Andre has established a reputation as a cult comedian. He's probably best known for his talk show parody, The Eric Andre Show, which airs on Adult Swim. The show deconstructs the talk show format, figuratively and literally. Each episode opens with Eric running onto the set and destroying his desk and pretty much everything else that's there. But Eric is about to showcase his stand-up comedy work with his debut Netflix special, Legalize Everything. We zoomed in with Eric, where we weren't spared his trademark restlessness and spontaneity, to talk about the special, which covers politics, race, and identity. He talks about how being the son of a Jewish mother and a Haitian father influenced his comedic voice.
I think it's pretty blatant. I feel like the majority of my jokes are about race, race politics, life, death, poverty, racism, existentialism, and the problems with organized religion and Calvinism.
Yeah. In your special, you talk about smoking marijuana with your mother. What was that experience like?
It was cool. It was a little awkward because I'm a little awkward when I smoke, but she was, she couldn't really inhale it. She kept like choking. So I gave her a little weed fortune cookie that I got from the farmer's market. And then she ate that and she got stony baloney, and then she was like...
And then 20 or 30 minutes later, her eyes got all red, and she looked up at me, and she goes, "My mouth is dry. Is that part of the appeal?"
And then she gave up. She's like, we were playing Scrabble, and she was like, "I want my wine. I don't like this."
Your special is called Legalize Everything, and during the special, you mentioned that you think all drugs in the U.S. should be legal except for the hallucinogenic salvia, and you also want to legalize sex work, but there must be a few things that you think should remain illegal.
Yeah, I mean, legalize everything is like tongue-in-cheek.
I'm not really saying.
I don't think we should legalize murder.
Yes, yeah, that was the first thing that came to my mind.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Murder, rape, burglary, those things can remain illegal.
Yeah, I
hope people have some understanding of irony.
I think they do. To be able to appreciate your comedy, they have to have some understanding of satire and irony, I think. You say that we should abolish the federal government and that you should run for president. What would your political policies look like if you were to run for president?
I think I laid them out in the special. I think all drugs should be decriminalized. I think sex work should be decriminalized. I think we shouldn't have guns with like double banana clips that like you can just press the trigger once and 100 bullets can spray out because you don't need that for hunting. But I would have fun laws. Like I think like moonshine should be legal. I think firecrackers should be easily accessible. I would have some fun laws. You know what I mean?
And should firecrackers be accessible all year round? Because the reason I ask, we have a dog, our dog Violet Wigglesworth, you know, doesn't like the firecrackers. And at least, you know, it's only during holidays usually. But you think that all year round, 365 days a year?
I gotta give my redneck constituents something to hold on to. I'm kind of taking away some fun toys. But I'm giving them cocaine and hookers. So I hope that they should like at least appreciate that, but it's really, you got to convince the rednecks or you're not going to win the election, at least in America. I mean, I could put a GoFundMe together, buy my own island, and then start a country on my own island, but I wouldn't have any constituents.
One of my favorite routines in your special involves a very clever insight that you make about the reality show Cops. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I guess there's no way to tell it without ruining the joke, but my joke is that I'm like, is it just me or is reggae the most inappropriate music they could have picked to open up the show Cops? Because I mean, like, it's just a montage of police brutality footage and state power, and you're playing the most relaxing vacation inducing music.
Kiss my boots, you disenfranchised transgender prostitute. Bam! Jamaica is a tropical island paradise. Bing, 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 bing. Our national currency is the delicious coconut.
Yeah, yeah. You also really enjoy interacting with the audience. And one of the ways that you do that in your special is something called autofill correct. Can you tell us a bit about autofill correct?
I take a kid's cell phone out from the audience and I'll text his mother. But the rule is I can only text her the it's not even autocorrect. It's like the autofill function.
Autofill, yes.
Yeah, in your text message when it tries to guess your next word in the sentence. Kind of shorthand. So like, it's like the game Mad Libs that you played as a kid. I just keep punching, like the phone picks the words. Mm-hmm. Phone is a random word generator and I just keep hitting the words until it creates the perfect mom confusion.
Zero stars for a good night. Probably my mom and her sister and her daughter in the shower. Not me. Take it up with Apple. Take it up with Apple.
Yes, and this is something I imagine that the origin story of is this is something you discovered while in your personal life while using your cell phone.
Yeah, I did it. My mom was the guinea pig. She was the first one. She was the first one I did it to. It worked well with her, and then I couldn't keep doing it to my mom over and over again on stage, so I started doing it to audience members.
Yeah, but at one point did you once do it to your mom on stage or never?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I did it to my mom on stage. It kind of like. I did it like spur of the moment and it got like such a huge reaction. Then I tried to do it again another night to my mom and she didn't buy it. So I started doing it to other moms in the audience that have just got such an immense reaction. It's also very relatable and it's G-rated. It's not harsh. You can't go too harsh with the moms or the audience kind of turns on you. You don't want to be mean to the moms.
Yeah.
But everybody can relate to mom confusion and it's totally G-rated after all this like hard R material.
Yeah, so. And another reason why you don't want to be mean to the moms besides the audience turning on you is because of your presidential campaign, you want to appeal to moms as well.
You got to appeal to moms.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you got to appeal to moms.
Yeah. You're probably best known for the Eric Andre Show, which you started doing in 2009. Where did the idea for this come from?
It was like just a mix of all my influences. It, you know, Space Ghost, Tom Green Show, Ali G Show, Chappelle Show, Ren and Stimpy, Wonder Shows in Jackass. It was kind of just like a mix. Jiminy Glick, Martin Short Show. You know, it was kind of just a hodgepodge of all my favorite shows in my brain.
Yeah. And your sidekick on the Eric Andre Show is another accomplished comedian, Hannibal Buress. How did you meet Hannibal?
We were doing open mics together in 2008, 2009, maybe even earlier, 2006. Yeah, 2006 was the earliest writings of the show. It was just love at first sight. I think he's just so funny and he's like completely opposite in energy. And we just have a great odd couple dynamic.
What should I do now?
I don't know, do a monologue or something.
Yeah, okay, I got that.
All right, so Michael Jackson, he hasn't been in the news too much lately, right? It's like, where are you hiding, Jacko?
He's dead, man.
Are you serious?
Work the crowd, man. Don't look at me.
All right, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's great chemistry for sure. Did it take some convincing to get Hannibal to be the quote-unquote Ed McMahon to your Johnny Carson?
No, not at all. In fact, it's the opposite. He quit. He quits mid-season this up-and-coming season, season five. Like, he was over the show. So, but in the beginning, before he was famous, he was just like, yeah, sure, whatever. I got all the time in the world. Now he's very successful.
Mm. So that's a spoiler alert right there, isn't it?
I've been debating whether I should spoil it or not, but I think like it's better to spoil. I used to like keep every single thing. You got to give people something to tune into and whatever.
Sure, fair enough. The intro to each episode of the show really grabs the viewer's attention. Can you tell us what happens and where the idea came from?
The idea came from one time Tom Green just started, he jumped up and he started destroying his set during an interview, and it was just like totally spontaneous. And he never did it again, but I remember being 16 years old and being like, oh, he should do that every single second of his show.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Eric Andre Show!
So part of it came from that. Also, like, I wanted to grab the viewer's attention when I was trying to sell the show, and we made the first version on our own.
Yeah, you made a sizzle reel in an abandoned bodega in Bushwick, if I recall correctly. Is that right?
Yeah.
And you pitched it to all the networks, but it was only Adult Swim that...
Yeah, oh, yeah, everybody passed except Adult Swim loved it, yeah.
But that's a perfect fit, because your production...
Yeah, it's like that was the top choice anyway, so...
There you go. So, yeah, so holy everything's fine with that. Absolutely. Yeah. Do you prepare your celebrity guests for the pranks and antics and you're on the show, or are they being ambushed?
Absolutely not. It's 100% ambush. I can't help what they watch before they come in, but we tell their publicists next to nothing. Like, we just get them a date and a time to show up, and they're just blindsided by everything. And we purposely try not to book guests that would watch Adult Swim or watch the show. We try to book guests out of the world of that kind of comedy. We don't book comedians.
Yeah. What kind of reaction do you get from them off camera after you've done the interview with them?
It's a whole spectrum. Some are relieved that it's over. Some of them are very upset. Mm-hmm. So it depends on the person's sense of humor about themselves.
Yeah. Is there a celebrity that sticks out for being really angry, really upset with you afterwards?
Lauren Conrad was probably the most pissed.
She's a great guest. I like her.
And T.I. wasn't thrilled.
I don't know what you're rapping at me right now. I haven't gotten the last album, but I have some incredible raps.
I am glad that you did not get it, because don't you touch me, man. No.
Hey, wait. You like Thai food? T.I. food? You get it? Like Thai food?
Yeah.
The show also features you pulling stunts and pranking people out on the streets. That kind of pure ambush is probably pretty unpredictable. You don't even know how it's going to go, do you?
Yeah, it's a little dangerous.
Yeah. Do the standards and practices ever jump in after the fact to tell you after you've filmed one of these things and say, no, you can't air that, Eric?
They never really go, you can't air that. They'll usually just like, you have to blur this or bleep this. It's usually like that. They're rarely... cut an entire bit. The only bit we ever got entirely cut, we had a country singer come in and sing a pro Al-Qaeda country song.
Oh, yeah.
And they cut that bit.
Yeah. What is there left for Eric Andre to do and to accomplish that you haven't already done?
I don't know. I want to do more hidden camera stuff, tour the Eric Andre Show live, more shows. I want to help some comedian friends produce their own shows. And I want to escape my country because it is completely disintegrating.
yeah, it is. Do you have any ideas? Like what, I mean, let's get back into this idea of Eric Andre running for president. Do you have any ideas of what needs to be done to repair?
I think my first day in office, I would abandon the country. I would just leave. I'd move to Tahiti.
Eric Andre, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Eric Andre is a comedian and the host of The Eric Andre Show on Adult Swim. His debut Netflix stand-up special, Legalize Everything, starts streaming this week on June 23rd. Find out more about Eric at wpr.org/beta.
I coalesce the vapor of human experience into a viable and logical comprehension.
That's Frankenstein.
Is anybody gonna die? I don't
have a name. Der Schwartz.
I am Frau Blücher.
That lovely audio montage means it's time for another installment of our docuseries about Mel Brooks films, Young Blazing Producers, with Milwaukee's Patrick McGilligan. He is the author of Funny Man, Mel Brooks. Today, Pat tells us about Mel's 1974 horror comedy, Young Frankenstein. While this movie may be Brooks' high watermark as a director, the idea for the movie was actually the brainchild of another Milwaukeean, the film star Gene Wilder.
Gene wrote most of that script, and he'd write it after sitting around and talking with Mel for a long time and, spitballing ideas for scenes and characters. And then Gene would go away and do most of the writing, and then Mel would read it, and he would critique it, and he would change it. And that's how that script grew. So it really is a Gene Wilder script. And consequently, it's Gene Wilder's showcase as an actor. He's really anchors the film with a very delightful performance.
I alone succeeded in discovering the secret of bestowing life. Nay, even more, I myself became capable of bestowing animation upon lifeless matter. It can't work!
You know, Mel is not in the film because Gene early on said, "Mel, I don't want you to be in the film because you'll break the fourth wall. You'll wink at the audience, and I really want to present this as like a serious comedy about Young Frankenstein." I'm not sure how he won that argument, except that he had the upper hand. He was writing the script, and he wanted Mel just to direct. Consequently, I think it's Mel's best directed film because he was focusing on the performances and on the scenes, and it's very, very smoothly and beautifully directed, very beautifully designed. The performances are just perfect, and you might miss Mel because Mel could be very funny on the screen in his parts. He's very funny in Blazing Saddles, for example. But nonetheless, it makes it his strongest film as a director.
Yeah, and it's interesting that while filming Blazing Saddles, Gene Wilder had been very impressed with his co-star Madeline Kahn, and so Gene had suggested that she play Dr. Frankenstein's assistant Inga, but she didn't. Why not?
She wanted the other part. But that opened the door to Terry Garr, who was having a romantic relationship with Gene Wilder at the time. And she's really very cute and very funny in the film.
In other words, his veins, his feet, his hands, his organs would all have to be increased in size.
Exactly.
You know, with Madeline Kahn, she began with Blazing Saddles to have some say-so over what she would do and what she wouldn't do. And she would add those little things, you know. I mean, you don't hear the same things about Gene Wilder in Young Frankenstein. He was following the script that he wrote.
Yeah.
Or about Peter Boyle or about Terry Garr.
Yeah.
But, you know, Madeline Kahn would always do little things to improve what her idea of what she was doing in the scene. And Madeline Kahn had a long, really great career doing a lot of things, but she's remembered most nowadays for her Mel Brooks films.
Yeah. All of the women, Madeline Kahn, Terry Garr, and Cloris Leachman, are all really great in Young Frankenstein. How much do you think their performances contributed to the movie's success?
Well, it's a beautifully written script, so
yes.
The performances were written into the script and the characters, and then it's beautifully cast by Mel, and so he gets Cloris Leachman, who was on television but wasn't really famous as that kind of over-the-top comedian that she becomes in Mel Brooks' films.
That music.
Yes, it's in your blood. It's in the blood of all Frankensteins. It erases the soul when words are useless. Your grandfather used to play it to the creature he was making.
And it was you all the time.
Yes.
You played that music in the middle of the night.
Yes.
So that I would.
Yes.
Then you and Victor were.
Yes. Yes. Say it. He was my boyfriend.
Mel is not really known as a great director of actors. I mean, because they're playing in various ways in his films, cartoon characters. But he's very, very good at getting types or performers who are really going to go off on the script and really take the script a notch higher. And you see that casting, I think, really, really particularly done well in his earliest films.
When Mel would just pull lightly on the reins for Madeline or me or Cloris, if he wasn't getting what he wanted, he would start tugging.
Gene Wilder and Mel Brooks had a lot of disagreements about the script. Can you talk a bit about that?
Sometimes with Mel, you never knew. Sometimes he might set up an argument just so that he could win it, you know. So, for example, he decided that he didn't want to have the monster sing an Irving Berlin song.
dressed up like a million-dollar trooper, trying mighty hard to look like Gary Cooper.
Cooper, Cooper!
Come, let's mix where Rockefellers walk with sticks or umbrellas in their midst.
Gina put it in there because he knew Mel would like it, and Mel didn't like it. And Mel screamed at him, if I put this in, everybody's going to accuse me of repeating myself and doing the same kind. You know, and they really would have very screaming arguments. And then at the end, Mel would say, okay, it's in. And Gene would say, why now do you say it's in? And Mel said, you convinced me by your intransigence.
Yeah.
Despite all that, after all the years that followed, all the decades that followed, they never worked together again on another film.
Patrick McGilligan is the author of Funny Man, Mel Brooks. You can find out more about Pat and Young Frankenstein at WPR.org/beta.
For quite a while, I've always felt alone, and that is how I perceive things. It's through the filter of my own consciousness.
Otessa Moshfegh joins us to talk about her latest novel, Death in Her Hands. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is easy, I thought, to find great affection for victims, emblems of vanished potential. There is nothing more heartbreaking than a squandered opportunity, a missed chance. I knew about stuff like that. I'd been young once. So many dreams had been dashed, but I dashed them myself. I wanted to be safe, whole, have a future of certainty. One makes mistakes when there is confusion between having a future at all and having the future one wants.
That's Otessa Moshfegh reading an excerpt from her latest novel, Death in Her Hands. The story follows the widow Vesta as she becomes more and more engrossed in a local murder mystery. Otessa proves once again that she is one of today's leading fiction writers, in large part because of her inimitable literary voice. She and her dog, Walter, who shares a name with a character in the book, joined us from her home in Pasadena to talk about the book and how it came about.
The process of me writing this book was different from any other book that I'd written. What I did was I sat down and said, I need to write a novel right now. Like, literally, that's just what I said to myself. I wrote the opening lines, which are the note. Her name was Magda. Nobody will ever know who killed her. It wasn't me. Here is her dead body. And then for the next however many months, I wrote 1,000 words a day with zero plan and made a deal with myself that I would never read what I had written on any previous day. And I would keep to this 1,000 word minimum until I had reached the end of a novel. And I had no idea what novel that was going to be, but it very quickly showed me that it was Vesta's novel, that it wasn't necessarily Magda's novel. So Vesta was the one who started talking in my mind. She was the one who was describing finding the note, this lovely to listen to voice that has been poetically transcribing the nature and, you know, the path that she walks on and the rhythm of her dog running beside her and all those kinds of things. And so she introduced herself to me in a way that made me want to keep going. But like with every novel, the person that you meet on page one is not revealing everything, you know, that the point of reading is that we want to know what is going to be revealed. So that was how I wrote the book too, waiting for more to be revealed each day by this character.
Your book, Death in Her Hands, it becomes very metafictional when you're writing about Vesta, creating profiles of Magda and suspects in her possible murder. At one point, Vesta questions the first sentence of your novel. Her name was Magda. What kind of opening was that? An editor would deem the note too dark to publish. Why did you want to get kind of metafictional like that?
Why did I want to? Well, because so much of this book is about writing a book.
Mm-hmm.
Vesta sets out to solve a murder the way that a novelist sets out to write a detective novel. And that's literally what she does. She goes and Googles how to solve a mystery and gets top tips for mystery writers.
Sure, but she uses Ask Jeeves.
Yes.
Yeah, she uses Ask Jeeves.
So she's really got the inside tip there.
Yes. yeah.
Yeah, so to me it was, you know, it's a meditation on the imagination. You know, I mean, that's what mystery is. It's delving, or that's how you solve a mystery in your mind, is you go inward, you look for clues, you follow the breadcrumbs, and that's also kind of how we live life, you know, and it doesn't always come to a very clear ending as you know, a great Agatha Christie novel would, you know. Or like in Clue, like it was him in the courtyard with
Colonel Mustard in the courtyard,
yeah,
with
Colonel Mustard
with the wrench or whatever. Yeah. So yeah. So the word, I was struck by how often the word mind space occurs in Death in Her Hands, and because the story is told in the first person, you're taking us inside Vesta's mind. But with this use of mind space and these metafictional moments that we've been talking about, you're kind of also taking us inside your own mind, because as you mentioned, this is a book in which she's approaching trying to solve this possible murder as a writer would. So do you think that was that something you were intentional about? Did it feel like while you were writing it that's what you were doing, that giving the reader also a glimpse into the way you write?
I didn't feel that way, actually. Mm-hmm. I felt like I was very much inhabiting the mind of a different character than my own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting because you're like, well, is it your mind or whose mind is that? And that's kind of the question that Vesta's asking too. That what is a mind? What space does it occupy? If you feel that someone has occupied your own mind space, is that real? You know, like, was I occupying her mind space by writing that book?
Mm, yeah. yeah.
You know, Vesta and I don't think in any certain terms, I could say, like, in a similar way.
Yeah, Death in Her Hands is similar to your previous novel, My Year of Rest and Relaxation, in the sense that both the protagonists are women who are isolating themselves from others, but they're doing it for different reasons. What is it about this loner type that you find so interesting to write about?
I think it's because that's the way that I had been my whole life. I had felt like a loner, even though I had had times of being very social, especially when I lived in New York. I felt, you know, really engaged in life outside of my apartment. For quite a while, I've always felt alone, and that is how I perceive things. It's through the filter of my own consciousness. You know, the same is true for McGlue as well. I mean, that's a character who's basically incarcerated for the entire novella. And it's true about a lot of my short stories. I mean, you know, partly I think maybe I've had until recently something like a resistance toward great action movement in a plot. And I've been more interested in interior vocalization of thought and storytelling in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Storytelling in performative way, like I write almost exclusively up until now, the thing I'm working on currently, I have written almost exclusively in the first person. So my narratives read like monologues sometimes, and that kind of oral writing really lends itself well to freedom, basically. You can go anywhere. You can jump back and forth through time. You can revisit a memory over and over again and remember it a thousand different ways. You can give an opinion. You can talk about your opinion and disagree with yourself and then be somewhere else and someone is talking to you. It's just like, I love that form.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it because it allows for infinite interiority, you know, according to the parameters of each book. Each book has its own kind of rules. So I like to set the rules that I can go deep inside as well as, you know, outside. So
yeah,
that's what I like to do.
And I think it's what we like to read, too. That's part of what makes your work so compelling. Vesta comes across to me as an unreliable narrator. Does this mean that there are multiple ways to interpret the events that occur in the course of the book, especially the ending?
Oh, I think there are always multiple ways to interpret anything, because that's the whole thing about language. It's just words. And words require interpretation. But yeah, I think that the end of Vesta's story has a sense of, I want to say dissolution, but I actually think the more precise word is dissolvency or something, where we feel her grip on tactile reality somehow dissolve into the water of her fictional mind space. Mm-hmm. That sounds so weird, but yeah. It's just this kind of thing that happens in the writing. And I think, you know, if you're a very, very, very literal reader, you might, you know, stumble on that. Like, that might catch you or trip you up, and then you might get a little confused and try to figure out, like, well, what's really going on here? But if you're a more poetical reader or willing to take that on, I think there's potential for a kind of, I don't want to call it ecstatic, but because that's too positive, that's too subjective. But there is some kind of, maybe just metaphysicality that's going on in the evocation of these last couple of pages for Vesta, where we think maybe she is ascending outside of her body into her mind space. Like, maybe this is her death. And if it is, it's kind of beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. The writer Gia Tolentino has said that you're, quote, easily the most interesting contemporary American writer on the subject of being alive when being alive feels terrible, end quote. We're in the midst of this coronavirus epidemic. Does being alive now feel even more terrible than usual to you?
No. I mean, I also don't necessarily agree with that statement.
No?
No, I don't. I don't think that summarizes what I do.
Okay, can you correct that? Like, can you give us a summary of what you would do that would be more accurate, coming straight from you?
I don't think that I'm only writing about feeling terrible.
No, I agree.
I think I'm writing about many, many things. And I think that feeling terrible, as I dramatize it or novelize it in my projects, is something that people are drawn to because it's interesting to watch a person suffer, and it makes for, you know, good drama. But I do think that's, I've heard that quotation before, although I understand that it is enormously flattering, I don't want to be remembered just for that. And so I don't mean this in a way at all to dismiss your question, Doug. Like, I appreciate your asking it and bringing it up, because it is a really important time and a lot of people are feeling very terrible, and it is completely beyond me how to address anything that is happening with clarity and focus without being very heartbroken.
Is there a ritual, perhaps a daily ritual that you have that's helping you to maintain your sanity these days?
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually living quite like Vesta. Like, I make a list of things to do in the morning, and definitely includes taking a walk with my dog. Almost every night at 6 o'clock, I have a Zoom meeting with my sister, my husband, and a very close friend to process through different topics or things that have come up. And it's a nice space to have. And it is, like, intimate and a place for me to challenge myself. And it's definitely not like therapy or support group per se. It's like a reality group, I guess. Mm-hmm. So I do that, and I've been eating a lot of popcorn.
That's good. Otessa Moshfegh, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug. It's great to talk to you again.
Otessa Moshfegh is the author of Death in Her Hands. It will be available June 23rd. It's her third novel. Find out more about Otessa at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Chuck Wendig, Eric Andre, Patrick McGilligan, and Otessa Moshfegh. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast via Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Special thanks to producer Brad Kohlberg.
Oh, you must have been the tallest one in your class.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Love is the only thing that can save this poor creature.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Do you also say Friedrich?
And thanks to you, our elves. Please be safe out there. We'll see you next week. I'm Doug Gordon.
You've got it, mister.